You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
I was really looking forward to this podcast, and then we just finished recording, and it's great. My guest is Kirk Gray, who's a professor in psychology and neuroscience at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, where he directs the Deepest Beliefs Lab and the Center for the Science of Moral Understanding. He is the co-author of the book, The Mind Club: Who Thinks, What Fees, and Why It Matters. He has a new book. It's called Outraged: Why We Fight About Morality and Politics and How to Find Common Ground. Enjoy the pod.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job, at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Kirk Gray, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
I literally changed my first question to you this morning around 10 a.m. And this is after a conversation with my colleague Bailey, who sits in the office across from me at Second City, which I'm pointing to. She stopped in my doorway and asked if I had seen the content that was popping up online in the wake of the murder in New York City yesterday of Brian Thompson, who is the CEO of UnitedHealthcare. So people on my side of the aisle, meaning left-wing or left-leaning, they're taking delight in this cold-blooded killing of this man that I'm certain that 99.9% of them didn't know. And the few folks who posted objections to people posting this content were also countered by people defending this content on the grounds of the problems in our healthcare system in the United States. Problems I certainly have concerns with, but I was really like this taken aback, aghast at this, and really feeling like, oh, wow, are we doing this right now? Is this what we're doing? And I'm just curious if you saw this, because it feels so germane to the book you just wrote.
Yes, I did see this, and I also immediately thought about how we're divided and why folks on the left might be celebrating the murder of a CEO, right? Clearly, a sad family, but thinking of like who is the gunman? Does he have a set, right? Like, yeah, I mean, it's like it's a microcosm of the entire kind of divided nation and the different ways that folks on the left and the right see who or what might be vulnerable to harm.
Because I also thought, like, well, if this is the argument you're making, then how do you get upset when someone shoots up an abortion clinic?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point, right? It's the exact opposite idea, but it's the same thing, right? I mean,
the same thing.
Right. Someone's causing harm to someone that you think is evil, but at the end of the day, you're still causing suffering to innocent humans. But, you know, that's not how our moral minds work, right? We pick a side and we see some people as vulnerable and some people as invulnerable villains.
So when we first started with the podcast and after my book and started working with the folks at the University of Chicago, I became acquainted with the term me search. And your book starts with a me premise. Can you talk about the thing that happened when you were tooling around in your new car after getting your driver's license, and what happened, and how that perhaps maybe might have been the starting point to your interest in this subject matter?
Yeah, it was a 1989 Pontiac Grand Am, maroon. It was totally sweet. Two door, Doc 16, you know, as like the things you notice as a 16-year-old boy. It later exploded basically on the way to a road trip, and I sold for scrap metal. Oh, no. It's a whole different story. Maybe that's my yes and story. But we were driving at night, friends in the back, to a movie theater. It was dark. It had just rained. We were late. I was racing up this road, just about to miss the turnoff, made the turnoff, didn't look in the blind spot. There was a brand new Mercedes-Benz there. I spun, he spun, we didn't hit anyone, we didn't hit each other, no one was hurt, but, you know, it was terrifying. I was reckless, and we stopped. I rolled down my window, he gets out of the car, I apologize, and he points to me and says, "You're dead, I'm going to kill you." And, you know, oh my goodness, a 16-year-old boy, you know, I just got my license, oh my God. I step on the gas, he gets back in the car, follows me, we, you know, car chase around these strip malls, kind of like suburban Calgary where I grew up. Eventually he corrals me into a loading dock behind a Home Depot. And, you know, I'm stuck, no one's around, you know, bad things could happen. Canada, you know, doesn't have handguns. It's probably a good thing in this situation. And so I'm apologizing. He tries to unlock my, he tries to open my door. I, you know, lock it just in time. He reaches in through my window as I'm apologizing, slaps me around and does this for a while, tries to unlock my door from the inside. I'm terrified. Everyone in the car is paralyzed with fear, except someone in the middle of the back seat says, "Hey, I've got a cell phone," rare at the time, it was in the 90s, yeah, "and I'll call the cops." And so he keeps slapping me for a little bit, and then pauses, reflects slightly, and he says, "Yeah, you call the cops, and I'll tell them what you did." And that moment for me was, obviously I was like terrified still, but it, you know, it's hard to not think, what are you talking about? You're assaulting me. Yeah. You literally threatened to kill me and are trying your best to do so now through my window. What makes you think the cops are going to be on your side? Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think from his perspective, he's like, I almost killed him. You know, I'm driving recklessly, and he's got this like righteous indignation, this retaliation for the harm that I perpetrated upon him. And so we're both fixated on the harm and the injustice that we felt, we suffered, and it was hard to see the other perspective. And so that kind of formed the nucleus of eventually that came my career studying moral psychology and our kind of competing moral convictions about issues.
I had a great playwriting teacher, and I talk about this a lot because she always says, if you can't tell me what your play is in a sentence or two, you don't have a play. And you actually make that early in your book, where you say, the argument of this book is simple. We have a harm-based moral mind. Our evolutionary past makes us worry about harm, but people today disagree about which threats are most important or more real, creating moral outrage and political disagreement. Pretty clean assessment, and I know it probably took years and years and years, if not decades, to get there to that. And not everyone has felt this way in terms of the people who talk about this in academia.
That's right. And it did take a long time. And you know, folks who are listening can't see this, but there's a nice figure to go along with that, right? It's this people running from giant birds that are trying to eat them and then burning flags and yelling people, right? So I just want to say the visual, I also worked hard on that visual. But it did take a long time to come up with that premise. And there's a lot of studies that went into this idea that we have a harm-based mind. And a lot of those studies, especially at first, even still, don't get a great reception sometimes in my subfield, because there's different ideas, I think wrong ideas, about how our minds work and the difference between liberals and conservatives. But my work challenges that idea, that popular misconception, I think, that liberals and conservatives have different values or different foundations. Instead, we all care about harm. And that's really what morality is in its entirety, how we make sense of harm and how we try to protect ourselves.
So let's start with the sort of evolutionary aspect of, I think for many of us, certainly in contemporary society, looking at humans, we see ourselves as the predatory beasts, right? I'm listening to this podcast right now. It's the Rest Is History podcast, and it's about Columbus. And it is barbaric in terms of what he did. And that's going back, you know, so long ago. But you're suggesting that our minds don't necessarily conceive of ourselves as predators, but prey.
Yeah, I mean, I like that you said so long ago when Columbus you know, came to the New World. I mean, it's not that long ago.
I guess it's not that long ago.
Right. I mean, we had modern ships. We had modern weapons. I mean, I think if you want to understand the human condition, you need to go back 4 million years to before we were modern Homo sapiens. We were like Australopithecus, right? Mm-hmm. You know, the primates who we eventually evolved into. And it's kind of like those roots that are really grounded in us being prey. Like today, sure, we can hunt wolves from helicopters. Sure, hundreds of years ago, Columbus could, you know, give diseases to folks in the New World and kill all the animals he wanted to eat. But back then, we were smaller, our ancestors. We lived in fear all the time. I mean, you know, big cats would eat us in the darkness. Giant eagles would literally pick up our children and carry them away to devour them in nests. Mm-hmm. It was a terrible time to be alive. And even today, I mean, there's so many people who are still killed by tigers in India, right? Tall grasses, you walk home. I think the exercise I encourage people to do is you can strip down. I mean, you don't have to be naked. You just put on your bathing suit, go into a forest just as dusk falls and like wait for night to come and then just see how you feel. Do you feel like a predator? Do you feel like when that twig snaps behind you, like, oh, good, I hope it's something I can eat? No, you think it's someone going to eat me. And so I think at a heart of hearts, we're not apex predators deep down. Instead, we're more prey.
So our work, as you could probably infer, at Second City, improvisation in ensembles and groups and teams. How do we effectively work together? And so many of these exercises that are the foundation for the training are all about anything the other person says is correct, that we all have each other's back, that all of us are better than one of us. And these are sort of ethical and moral concepts, I think, as well. And many people have seen, you know, that tie. So how do we get from prey to this idea of social beings who develop this sort of morality?
Right. So each of us individually is very weak. The other thing I like people to do is to look at your fingernails and ask yourself if those are the claws of an apex predator. And they are not, right? Like you look at a tiger, even your house cat is like more built for killing than a human being. And so to escape the kind of threat of predators and living on our own, we had to form tribes where we could protect ourselves, work together. And so because we're a group species, like many other primates, we have to have rules so we can live together and not kill each other and not be threatened by the people around us. And that rule is morality, ultimately, right? We have to have these intuitions baked in. So we're like, you know, I wanted to steal this food because I'm hungry, but maybe I shouldn't because, you know, they might retaliate or our society might plunge into chaos. And so all of our kind of psychological, you know, moral convictions revolve around getting together better, not being antisocial, cooperating more. And it turns out, right, that though this like moral intuitions help us kind of prosper as a society and outcompete other societies that don't have a strong moral code. So it was really essential to the kind of evolution of morality and turning humans from like living in small tribes to big cities where, you know, you have to be moral because most of the time you're anonymous and you're away from the watchful eye of police, right? I mean, we have to be good people, and most people are.
And then that problem, though, okay, so we build these communities, these social communities, people, and we started the podcast, people murder each other. But then there's also this idea of, like, free riders or more modern freeloaders, like the people who don't do anything. And I guess in those olden times could be ostracized from the group. And if you're ostracized from the group, you're alone and you're out and you're dead. And when you talk about that, I can't help but flash forward to think of the moral panic around welfare queens.
Oh, yeah.
And then so then we talk about this thing with the CEO of UnitedHealthcare, where people are reacting basically in terms of like, well, you take advantage of people who are sick. And I don't know if you just saw, I'm sure it's no coincidence that this is popping up, but Blue Cross Blue Shield announcing that they may not pay for the entire anesthesia if a surgery goes too long.
Oh, wow.
That just came out.
Wow.
And you're like, and I get, so then you're like, oh, it's kind of the same thing that people are thinking about just from these completely different POVs.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, right, our morality evolved to kind of focus on people who are antisocial, who don't cooperate, and ultimately who harm us and our society. And so if you're fixated on the CEO of United and saying, look, he's harming us, right? I think United, I looked at the stat, right, because it was in the news about like how many claims they deny and their percentage of claims denied. It's like 30%.
Pretty high.
I mean, like, right, 30% of people who are in pain, who are suffering, United says no to help their bottom line. And of course, you know, you could say, well, the bottom line is important to stay solvent and whatever. But I also think many people see a lot of greed and, you know, stock buybacks when they could be helping your mother get dialysis, whatever, right? And so at the same time, right, we also evolved to think murder's wrong. And so there are these competing intuitions. But I think, if you're thinking of a CEO as like intentionally harming people, then he's not a victim anymore. In people's minds, he's a villain. And our morals are hardwired to kind of want to punish villains and kick them out of our group and ultimately maybe even to kill them. And so it makes sense when you think of our evolution. I mean, obviously it doesn't make it right, but it also comes down to kind of like what harms and are you fixated on and who really seems vulnerable?
You write in the book, quote, here's the puzzle. If you look how parents treat their kids, you'd be convinced that the world is more dangerous than ever, end quote. So we've heard these stories, right? The mom who let kid was misbehaving, so she said get out of the car and walk like six blocks to home, and then suddenly gets arrested for this, right, even though it's perfectly safe. And I grew up at a time where there was no cell phone. I walked everywhere. And the rule was get home when it gets dark. And that, and that was it. I sent my kids down the block in the city of Chicago to go play in the park, which was completely fine. And then they came home. And this leads to this these ideas that you talk about, concept creep and harm creep. I think those are really important. Can you talk about those?
Sure. So, again, if you think of the past, right, so we evolved being afraid in large part, right? There's big animals, there's natural disasters, whatever. So we're afraid. Fast forward to today, we're still afraid, right? You can't shake that fear. Just like we still today, we love sweets, even though, right, it's bad for us to like them now, right? Evolution kind of made it so we like things that taste like Doritos, and then companies take advantage of us by giving us Doritos. But when it comes to fears, the landscape has also changed in that now we're safe, but we're still looking for those threats. And so because we're compelled to see them, we in some ways invent threats that we didn't used to see, things that used to be seen as mild or innocuous because we're no longer in extreme danger. Most of the time we see those mild threats as more severe than we did before. So letting your kids walk home alone, you're like, sure, back in the day that was fine because it turns out that kids were much more likely to die in kind of auto accidents or lock themselves in fridges. I remember those kind of things, like don't lock yourself in a fridge.
I don't know what to tell my kid.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Cause like fridges don't lock anymore. Or, you know, there weren't seatbelts. No. Christmas trees had candles on them.
Yes.
Right. I mean, I talked to my mom. I mentioned this in the book a little bit. I talked to my mom and she grew up in Northern Canada in the 50s and 60s. And she just told me like casually all the kids she knew who died from just like terrible accidents. Like a kid was driving along the highway and just like opened his door at speed because there's no child locks. And, just, you know, the 3-year-old fell out and died. I mean, it's tragic, but it happens so much. And today, so much safer to be a kid, so much safer to be an adult. And so we still have this innate desire to protect our children and to, you know, stamp out harm. And so now we see things that like, you know, were generally mild, like, you know, expressions, right? We like that speech is dangerous, or letting your kid walk around, that's dangerous. And so we've seen a creep, as you say, of the concept of harm.
So this idea, basically, the safer we become, the more we can see or seek these sort of outrageous, seemingly outrageous moral positions. It's such a paradox, right?
Yeah, it's a paradox. I mean, and this is, I mean, in some ways, this is the human condition, unfortunately, right? So the better your life is, right, we adjust in our happiness to like some set point. And so it's hard to change our human experience, right? We could be surrounded by, you know, I'm sitting in a nice office now in a comfortable chair, which is much nicer than how people lived 1,000 years ago, right? But I'm still like, oh, I'm a little uncomfortable. Like my socks are a little tight, right? I mean, you fixate on the things that you want to make better. And when it comes to morality, you fixate on evils, you fixate on harms. And it's just more salient, these minor things, when we're otherwise safe. So it is a paradox, but it's kind of how our mind, you know, works. And if you go to something that's much more dangerous, then it adjusts and doesn't creep in that way, right? So if you move your family to somewhere where there's like deadly diseases and dangerous disasters and lots of threat, then you're like, well, maybe I'm not so concerned about a bully giving you a dirty look, you know?
Mm-hmm. So I have a love-hate relationship with the work of Jonathan Haidt. This has gone on for a while. On the one hand, something I think probably you and I both agree with is his idea of kids need to have more play and be out in the world. Totally. I'm like down with that. And, you know, I was going to maybe have him on the podcast. We have a lot of mutual friends and he was lovely. He was too busy, but he was very lovely in our back and forth and communication. And his last book came out and I'm like, I don't know what I'm buying and on all this stuff. There's a famous and somewhat gross scenario that attempts to show this idea that harm matters for only some morality, which was constructed by Haidt. And this becomes kind of an important, I think, point in your book as a construct where someone is maybe trying to say, no, you're wrong. And you're saying back to them, no, I think I'm right on this. Is that correct? Right. What that world is?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I mean, do you want me to go through the scenario? You want me to?
Yeah, it's gross, but I think you should.
Okay, I feel like this is a yes and moment, right?
It is a yes and moment.
Yes, I will talk about consensual incest.
Great.
So, I mean, I'll back up just a little bit to give some more context, which is that everyone in the field of moral psychology agrees that people condemn obvious interpersonal harm like assault and murder. Everyone agrees that morality evolved to kind of protect us from harms. I mean, even Haidt, you know, talks about we moralize all sorts of things to keep us safe ultimately. But where the disagreement comes is some folks like Haidt suggest that, like, well, our moral mind is divided up into lots of little boxes or rooms. One of those boxes is about kind of obvious interpersonal harm, like assault. But some of those boxes are totally disconnected from harm. They're just about a value, let's say, of purity.
Yeah.
Right. And so the example that's used to support this argument that people condemn things like purity totally separate from harm is the following. Mark and Julie are brother and sister. And I should say, when I do the scenario the very first minute of my class at the beginning of the semester, I'm like, here's what moral psychology is, buckle up. And the students are always disgusted, but appreciate it.
It's interesting. So, yeah.
So here's Mark and Julie, they're siblings. One spring break, they decide to go up into the mountains. They're staying in a cabin. You know, after a day of hiking outside, they're making some spaghetti. They open some wine. This is my version of it. You know, they sit next to each other. Their legs are touching. Oh, they think that's nice. You know, they like rub each other's leg. Think that's nice. They lean in for a kiss. That's nice too. And eventually decide to make love. You know, Mark uses a condom. Julie's on birth control. They enjoy it. They never do it again. They never tell their parents. Right. So the scenario says it's harmless. This act is harmless. And then you ask people like, is it wrong? And not everyone, but many people say it's wrong. And so Haidt and his collaborators hold this example up as saying, look, here's something that people condemn as wrong, and yet it's objectively harmless. And so there must be something other than harm that leads people to condemn this because it's objectively harmless. But here's the problem. Here is the problem with this. And that is that it's clear that morality, at least as moral psychology studies it, is not objective because people disagree about the wrongness of very many things, like, yep, you know, shooting a CEO. But moral psychology, I think, wrongly assumes that harms are objective, when in reality, they're matters of perspective or perception. And so I think if you think about the Mark and Julie case and you ask people, hey, is it harmless what they did? Their gut intuition And this is something that Hyde emphasizes. Morality is about our gut feelings. Well, so is harm. In their gut, when you ask people, is Mark and Julie harmless? They say no, right? You can't fight that feeling that they're doing something harmful. And in fact, in the original studies where Hyde talks about this, and I want to say this study is unpublished. So John has never published this. It's never passed peer review.
I realize that. It's never been published.
In fact, yeah, this is like the dirty secret of the field. John has a note at the top of this paper that's like, look, I'm too busy to publish this, but like everyone knows it's true. And so, you know, I think John's an amazing thinker, an amazing writer, but I don't think he did his due diligence here because it's not a published study.
Yeah,
it's not officially in the scientific record. I mean, there's been other ones anyways. So, but as part of this study, the experimenter has to argue with the participants and say, like, they're like, it's harmful. And they're like, no, it isn't. And they're like, no, but like, what if they have kids and those kids, you know, have disease? And they're like, no, I told you not. So you can tell their like intuition is that it is harmful, even if explicitly it's not. And so I can give you like an example, like people are up there in improv and you're like, you know what? It's totally safe. You're safe. Nothing can happen. It's just people watching you. And then they start sweating and you're like, what's happening? And you're like, they're like, I feel afraid. And you're like, but I just told you that it's totally safe to be, you know, up in front of an audience. And they're like, yeah, I just don't believe you that I'm safe. I just like, you just feel negative.
Which is by far 99.3% of the population will feel that way, even though there's no danger whatsoever.
Exactly. And so this is how our morals work, right? You see something, you see a white panel van driving around the neighborhood, and you don't think there's a locksmith that got lost. You think that person is abducting children, right? And that's just like your gut feeling. And so where John Hyde is absolutely correct is that morality is more a matter of our subjective gut feelings than our like conscious reasoning. But where he's wrong is about what harm is. Harm is also a subjective gut feeling. And when you understand harm that way, then you see, yes, it connects to our moral judgments. And when people have different kind of intuitions about harm, that's where moral disagreement comes. Not because of something like purity, right? Purity alone doesn't lead to moral condemnation. It's only when those kind of values are kind of combined with concerns about harm that you get moral outrage.
And you have one other sort of example in this realm, which I thought was really interesting, because I'm terrified of heights. And it's just gotten worse as I've gotten older. Like, if I'm looking on Instagram and I see someone standing at the edge of the Grand Canyon, my body goes cold. And you talked about this Grand Canyon skywalk experiment.
Yeah. So this is an example by Tamar Gendler. She's a philosopher at Yale, and she's the first one who kind of like formalized this. And I think it's a great example. And it's... Let me say that. I think it's a great example, and I think it's obvious to anyone who's afraid of heights like you, right? So there's this skywalk. It juts out over the Grand Canyon. It's transparent. You stand on it, and you look down through the glass, plexiglass, whatever, to the canyon below. I mean, it's terrifying to everyone. We evolved to be afraid of heights because they usually spell death for us. Yeah. And so imagine you came across someone who's just shaking and panicking on the Grand Canyon skywalk. And you said, hey, what's going on? You're like, why are you so afraid? And they say, well, I'm afraid I'm going to die. And you say, what? No, you can't be. It's objectively safe, right? They say on the website of the Grand Canyon skywalk, they could stack like 10 jumbo jets on there and be totally fine. And so, you know, for Hyde's logic, he'd have to be like, oh, they still think they're still reacting here on the skywalk, but they know they're objectively safe. So there must be some other reason why they're afraid. Maybe because they're so high up and they're close to God, like the purity module is triggering their fear in the Grand Canyon, right? Like this is the tortured logic. And I think, or you could just say, they don't believe you that it's, that they're so safe and they're still terrified, or like being in a plane, right? Like, oh my goodness, being in a plane safer than driving. But you know what? When someone's like sweating and, you know, convulsing because they're terrified, they just don't believe you. And so again, harm is this like intuition that we get, you know, from evolution, from what our parents tell us, from how we see the world as like dangerous or who's vulnerable. And it's this intuition that drives our intuitions of morale. And again, I should say it's not that everything's equally as harmful as murder, let's say, right? like, I don't think people who hear about Mark and Julie and consensual incest think it's as bad as something that's really, truly, objectively harmful. But they think it's a little bit harmful, and they think it's a little bit wrong. So we need to understand morality as kind of like a continuum. And so the more harm people see, the more immorality they see. And that's the theory. It's pretty simple.
I want to talk a bit about vulnerability. You write in the book, quote, liberals and conservatives disagree about who is especially vulnerable to victimization and therefore who most urgently needs protection from harm. People who lean left versus right make different assumptions of vulnerability. So, like, I guess from my mind, and I'm just thinking about this for immigrants, right? So I'm a left-leaning person. I look at this policy of immigration being completely insane. I might be justifying it in some data I've found somewhere that I've cherry-picked, but I essentially look at these people and look at them going, they're so, you know, vulnerable. And then the argument I hear on the other side, correct or not, I'm in a bubble like everyone, is that they're worried that these immigrants are taking jobs and killing people. Or in the words of our now president, you know, they're eating the dogs, they're eating the cats. They don't appear to be from my end, but that doesn't make it any less real for the people who believe that, I guess.
Right. So because we have this harm-based mind, we all agree we should protect people from harm. The real differences between liberals and conservatives is not any foundations or whatever, yeah. But because we see different people, different entities as more or less vulnerable. And I think immigration is a perfect example, right? So progressives see illegal immigrants in terms of, or undocumented immigrants. I mean, even that term, right, yeah, is like term. Bound up with like whether they're victims or villains, right? And so undocumented immigrants, you see, is like they're fleeing violence in their home country. They're separated from their children at the border. Oh my God, it's like the suffering so terrible. And then, you know, if you're anti-immigration, those folks can point to real stories of people who were victimized by illegal immigrants who like came across for like a drug cartel, right? Like a gang initiation ceremony for MS-13 or something. So, I mean, there's statistical differences, I think, right? Mm-hmm. There's probably fewer cartel members than there are people who are trying to start a new life in America. But those stories are real. And our mind kind of hinges onto those stories. I mean, I also think that the United CEO is a great example of this. In other work, right, we've shown that liberal folks really don't think that the powerful people, like CEOs, are capable of suffering in the same way that folks from marginalized groups are, right? Yeah. So for progressive folks, they kind of split the world into those who are really vulnerable, like, let's say, Muslims or transgender people or undocumented immigrants, you know, people from marginalized communities. So, you know, those are the oppressed. And then they see the other half of the world as like oppressors, and they're invulnerable. Like, think slave owners and slaves. Like, that's the template they project on the world, you know, at the like really far progressive end. And so if you see the CEO, it's like, you know, wealthy guy, you know, making decisions where people live and die, seems not to care about it. You're like, this guy can't suffer. And so his murder is not causing suffering in the same way that someone who's denied healthcare. That's a progressive ideal. And then at the far end of the conservative, they tend to see the world as more equal in terms of suffering. They focus less on statistical trends and who's likely to suffer more, and more just like, hey, everyone, if they're cut, would bleed. Everyone's capable of suffering. And so at the end of the day, you know, it's just about individuals and their choices, and we need to protect people from where they are. And so this is how you get these big differences.
So yeah, the book's not all doom and gloom. You actually point to even this point of the idea of vulnerability laying at the heart of these moral disagreements presents an opportunity. So this really struck home for me, and you and I were talking before we jumped on about our work with Nick Epley, which my podcast listeners know well about because we've been doing it for years and talking about that. And I was reflecting on this thing because I get brought in to speak to a lot of groups that would be like, why are they talking to like the comedy guy from Second City? You know, like, so I just did this talk for a bunch of McDonald's franchisee people up in Milwaukee, not necessarily my people. But my stuff resonates. And so I was talking in particular, And this ties into things you talk about. So I was describing an exercise that we created based on Nick's study when he sent grad students onto public transportation to have a talk with strangers.
I love that study.
I love the study. And what he had said to my wife, Ann, was, can you devise an exercise that can have people feel what it is to experience either a lack of self-disclosure or self-disclosure? And so Ann created this exercise, and I talked about it to this group of McDonald's franchisees. And I said, it's called Universal Unique. And she pairs people up and says, all right. And I actually paired them up. I'm pairing you up, and you're going to talk about grocery shopping, but you're going to talk about grocery shopping as how human beings do it, you know, so not specifics in terms of you, but how human beings do it. And people do that for about a minute. Not very interesting. And we said, take a beat. Now you're going to talk to each other specifically about how you grocery shop. And we let them do that for about 2 minutes. And the world is completely changed. They learn stuff about them. This is grocery shopping. But
right, so banal.
But we're all freaks, and like when I do it, I don't even get to the grocery store. There are so many things that are happening before that happens. And what I explain, and I talk about the fact that Ann and our daughter got very sick, and she was at Lurie Children's Hospital because she's diagnosed with cancer, stage 4 cancer. And we would have different caregivers come in who don't know us. And my wife, who designed this this exercise, is an introvert. I, of course, am not. And I would utilize this exercise. So a new person would come in. I go, I'm Kelly. This is Ann. We've both worked at Second City for over 30 years. This is our daughter, Eleanor. She goes by Nora. We have a 100-pound Bernese Mountain Dog whose name is Benchley, who's an asshole. Who are you? And then, they tell us the reciprocal nature of that. And we'd learn a little something about that. And it just changed the room and the experience. And we built ensemble with these people. And these people at McDonald's, like, I feel like I turned from the woke theater guy to someone they're like, oh, he went through this tragedy. And we lost Nora. It's a tragedy, right?
Right.
But and I'm reading your book, and you're talking about the fact that the storytelling can bridge these divides, but also what are our harm stories? And I'm like, that, in some regards, I think is a thing that I've been doing without understanding, because I'm not trying to convince them of anything. I'm trying to say we created this thing based on the science. We used it to great effect. It was very helpful, and in a very high stakes situation. So I don't know. It was just, I was like, it really sort of moved me at the end of the book of being like, wow, this is we've lived in these waters.
Yeah, I mean, you know, sorry for your loss first, and I think these stories of harm are so powerful, again, because we all share the same harm-based mind. But when we think about those on the other side, we forget. You know, moral psychology didn't realize it, but when you're trapped in political conflict too, you don't realize that people on the other side are all motivated to protect themselves and their families and society from harm. And so the way that you show others that you have the same moral minds and the same concerns isn't by throwing facts at each other. I mean, just like think of any moral conversation you've had where you're like, oh my goodness, that statistic you had, that's so good. I changed my mind. You're right. You know, never. It's like never. But what does work is, hey, here's why I believe what I believe because of this story. And, you know, so we ran this study where people have a debate about gun rights. And one of our experimental accomplices is like, look, the reason I'm pro-gun is because, and they either say, you know, people use guns so many times in self-defense in America, or my mom used a gun to defend herself from a home invader when I was a kid. And that conversation after the story is a very different conversation.
Sure, of course.
Right. So now you're like, you're trying to help someone understand, you're being vulnerable, you're showcasing that you're concerned about harm and protecting yourself. And I think if you can kind of tell those stories and disclose, I mean, Nick's, you know, a lot of his work is about how you can encourage this disclosure.
Yeah.
But like disclosing about your concerns and your worries and your fears and your stories of suffering, that goes a long, long way, especially, and you use this word of understanding, right? Like you're not trying to win. You're not trying to win this conversation. You're not like, I'm going to be the, you know, the most humanized person you've ever met, you know, in front of these caregivers or these, you know, the franchisees. You're just saying like, here's who I am. I'm trying to understand. And so if you go into moral conversations, conversations about politics with this idea, I'm going to win them, you've already lost. But if you go in with thinking, I want to understand better and I want someone to understand me, then it lends to stories and obviously goes much better.
When I was leaving, the person who hired me said the comment they got was, I don't normally go in for this inspirational woo-woo shit, but I like that.
Inspirational woo-woo. That's good.
Well, I think I should, that should be my blurb. All right. In a moment, I'm going to ask you for your yes and story, but I am betting that no author in the history of writing books has ever started a chapter with this line, no one thinks of Hitler's inner pain. I'm guessing you are a first who has ever written that sentence ever.
Well, you know, monkeys and typewriters, who knows, but probably not a lot. Not a lot of people.
But I think that's a really, this is a really compelling thing that you set up.
Yeah. And I might want to say, like, Hitler was abused as a child.
Yes.
You know, emotionally and physically. And I want to say right away, in no way does this excuse any of his actions. And I am not in any way condoning anything that he did or anything. Right. I'm like, no way. Yeah,
you wrote a book that is nothing but you walking a tightrope. You
were. Oh, my goodness. Yeah. My entire life studying this stuff. So, but I think there is a truth there that when we look at the world, and I think the United Healthcare CEO is a great example of this as well, right? We bin people into one of two camps as villains or victims. And we call this phenomena moral typecasting, mm-hmm. in much the way that we typecast actors into enduring kind of Hollywood roles, right? Like Daniel Radcliffe, you see that dude, you're not going to be like Daniel, you're going to be like Harry Potter,
yeah.
You know? And so that works with particular roles, but it really works with moral roles. If someone does something evil, then they, in your mind, are 100% evil. And if they cry, like Harvey Weinstein, right? Like, yeah. Clearly a predator. And then he walks into court, you know, with his trial. He's got like a cane and he's like grabbing his, I don't know, he's got a neck brace. What? And everyone's like, no. Like, yeah. That's bullshit, right? Yeah. Like, we know you're a villain. You're not a victim. That's it. And then, you know, there's other stories of people talk about this in the book. There's this 13-year-old kid who was abused by his dad and he would like try to move away with his mom, but then his mom dies and he goes to live with his dad and he's abused by his stepmom and they're like branding him and, you know, forcing him to have sex with his stepmom. I mean, just like brutal things. And then he kills his dad, his stepmom, and his stepsister. And if I just open with that, like, here's a boy who killed his family, you'd be like, he's a monster. But because I open with this, like, the trauma and the abuse, turns out that people are like, he's still a victim. And he actually, you know, barely got a prison sentence because of this trauma. And so in our minds, victim or villain. And so this can make conversation really challenging, because if your victim is their villain, you're seeing a totally different world, like 100%, right? And literally people say Hitler, like, oh, you know, this person's like Hitler. And then there, you know, some of my counter are like, no, this other person's like Hitler. And then it's just an argument of like, who's the most like Hitler? And so, you know, that makes conversation difficult. But at the base is this thing we all try to do to simplify the moral world, which is moral typecasting.
So how do you deal with the people who are going to come at you with the, well, you're both sizing it, especially right now, given the world we live in?
Yeah.
You've got to like hear this all the time. And I know I just, as somebody who read the book, I was like, well, this is a book about humanity and human phenomenon. And there are other things at play in the world. So the thing I immediately go to, which is, And I think my psychology professor in college probably taught me this, Ron Grossman, which is civil disobedience would not have worked against Hitler, you know, and Germans. And so I'm like, you know, that is just a phenomenon of the way we live in the world. But it doesn't change the kind of human stuff that you're talking about with regard to our psychology as human beings and groups and tribes and how we end in that. So, I mean, I feel this is a book that is less about political thing than it is about how human beings tick that might help you navigate a political realm, but is not necessarily a card to play within that. I don't know.
I mean, I make a very firm point initially in the book that I'm a moral psychologist. I study descriptively how our minds work. I'm not making a prescriptive judgment. I'm not saying how the world should be or how people should make their judgments. I'm also not saying that just because you're trying to understand the other side, you should give up your convictions. In fact, the opposite, right? I mean, we need our moral convictions. We need our ethical kind of North Star to show us the way. But if you want to affect social change, then you need to understand how people's minds work, and you need to understand how to build coalitions, especially if you feel like you're in the minority. So let's say you're a progressive and you're kind of reeling from losing an election that you thought you'd win, but in fact, you're in the minority, right? Like, you can protest, sure, right? Sure. You can do all sorts of things to affect change, but you can also kind of understand where someone's coming from and try to figure out what's going to convince them to kind of see your side of the story and to be not only sympathetic, but empathetic towards what you're coming from, right? You need allies. You need to build coalitions. So in some ways, you can still stick to your convictions heavily, but pragmatically, you need to have conversations, you need to build coalitions, you need to understand the other side, and you need to let them understand where you're coming from. So it, as you say, it's like a difficult thing to walk, especially there's a title of the first chapter that says, is understanding betrayal? And and I think that's people's intuition, but like, at the end of the day, we're part of the same country, we have to work together. And you know, to affect change, you need to understand where people are at.
No, and the opposite side of that is a zero sum game, and that's it says it all. No one survives from that. So you know,
right? And maybe the election is a zero sum game, right? Like, we just came off of the election, and it's structured in our society and in our country that like one side wins and the other side loses. But after, you know, the inauguration, you know, it turns out we all share the same president for 4 years. We share the same Congress for at least two. And so we have to figure out how to work together and understand where people are coming at. And if, you know, I think one problem is that, like, you're like, these are my convictions. And so if I just say it loud enough, everyone will understand and agree where they should. And if they don't, they're evil. Well, turns out the majority of people on the other side, even if they're psychopaths out there, are not evil. And it turns out that you need to think about how they see the world to make them see your point.
That's a great point. We always end the podcast with a yes and story. Do you have one for us?
I feel like I try to live my life with yes and a little bit.
Good.
You know, road trips and all sorts of zany things I can. But the the story that's maybe on my mind right now is that at the end of this year, I'm moving from the University of North Carolina to Ohio State University.
Oh.
Nick Epley's thrilled. You know, I'm close to Chicago.
Okay.
In the Midwest. And so when I got the request to interview, my wife and I were on vacation for the first time away from our kids in like 5 years. Turns out we, you know, probably already were infected with COVID. And I was feeling, you know, no, I don't want to interview, you know, it's fine. I'm happy where we are. I'm tired. And then I thought, you know, I might as well do it and see what it's like. And it was great. And then my wife interviewed and it was great. And now we're thinking about, you know, what's the very latest we can tell our children that we're ruining their lives and moving them across the country. But yeah, so that's a yes. And, you know, you just like, let's try this opportunity and see how it goes. And then it turns out it was good. So big changes. Right.
The book is called Outraged, Why We Fight About Morality and Politics and How to Find Common Ground. Kirk Gray, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thank you.
Getting to Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
streets.
Adulthood, no one survives.